Hiya, and welcome to the Flipside podcast. I'm Jess Gibson, and we're here to talk about all things community, contact, and connection. Whether it's chatting about local community projects, discussing physical touch, or getting to grips with neuroscience, we've got you covered. Today, I'm joined by three other guests. I've got Ellie Wildbore, who is a service user and employee at Sheffield Health and Social Care Trust. She is a patient ambassador in medical education and research. I've also got Professor Martin Weber, who is a professor of social work at the University of York, and Dr. Chris Wood, who is an art therapist and lecturer with the Art Therapy Northern Programme. So today we're talking about connecting people, and specifically in relation to a particular project that our guests are interested in at the moment. So I'm going to start with Martin. Would you like to just introduce yourself a bit more and tell us about this project? Because it's actually a lot to do with the research that you've been doing in your field.
Yeah, absolutely. Connecting people is a practice model for mental health professionals and other professionals to use in their work. And it's a way to support them to help people with their social connections. It goes back quite a long way, actually, where it started from. I think back to when I was a practicing social worker working in London. I was working alongside psychiatrists and psychologists and nurses, occupational therapists, and I found that as a social worker, we didn't really have a very strong evidence base about what we were doing. And we were working with support workers and others in the local community, really enhancing people's lives. But there wasn't anything in terms of outcomes, in terms of research of outcomes. And that really led me into a career, into research and education, to try to develop some of this, to give back to the profession so that social workers had a better knowledge and a better evidence base for what they are doing, and also able to justify their work with other mental health professionals. So the first study which led to connecting people was a qualitative study exploring good practice in a variety of different settings. And we talked to people in early intervention in psychosis teams, and we followed explored people's practice in third sector, very small social enterprises, other voluntary sector agencies and community projects to see what were the skills that are required to effectively connect people. And out of this, we worked with people who experienced social isolation and loneliness and with other professionals, with other workers, to develop a model, and connecting people came out of that.
Brilliant.
And we subsequently evaluated the model and found that it was effective at connecting people. And I can say more about it later.
Yeah.
There's a longer story to it. But.
Yeah. Thanks. Ellie, I'm going to move on to you after that, because as a service user and in your role as patient ambassador, how does what Martin's just said relate to some of the work you do or your experience?
I think it relates to both, like, really well. So I've had mental health problems for many, many years, and I've experienced a lot of, like, for me, social isolation hasn't been a big problem, but I have experienced, like, very negative connections in my life, like at worst times in my life, and it's been something that as I've like moved forward in recovery, I've had to learn to recognise which connections are helpful, which ones aren't, and a lot of my recovery has been down to making better connections, better like connections with people with similar interests, and then that's eventually led me to making more connections enough to start working in Sheffield Health and Social Care, and part of my role is also a lot of connections. So I work with the doctors of tomorrow, like educating them about psychiatry and giving them the opportunity to connect with someone who's been there and like lived the experience is really important and something that they don't necessarily get anywhere else. And then also in my role in research is literally connecting researchers with service users so we can get more participants in research. So it's a big part of everything.
Yeah,
I do.
Definitely. And in your role, Chris, as art therapist, is that similar experience for you?
Yeah, I do work with quite a lot of people who talk about, a lot of service users who talk about being very lonely, very isolated. Mm. So, for example, one man had been, he'd got quite a serious mental health diagnosis, and he'd been hiding in his flat for many years, and he was quite frightened about leaving the flat and going to groups. But he decided to give an art therapy group a go, and afterwards he talked to me about what happened to him as a result of that. So initially he came to the group, and he was able to just quietly be in the group with the other people while making art, and he didn't feel pressured to speak at first. And then gradually, as he came over several weeks, he realised in the company of the other people in the group that he could share things with them and begin to talk. And I think that initial step away from terrible isolation really was the first step in him reclaiming some of his mental health. Then another man who has got quite a serious diagnosis as well comes to a group which has been running for quite a long time, and he finds it hard to, sometimes he's almost living in a nocturnal way, he's so worried about contact with people, so sometimes he finds it hard to get up and come to the group. And when he first arrives in the group, sometimes a bit late, he might not be able to be very coherent. Mm. But in the company of other people, gradually he becomes more able to think and share with them. And he actually encourages other people as well. Mm. So there's something about how much his mental health is helped simply by being in the company of other people.
Yeah.
In the past, I think it would have been easier for me to say to other mental health workers, do you think you could help this person have access to some other things? And I've got a lot of really good colleagues in the trust, but I think just at the moment with the resources the way they are, it might be hard for them to help someone like this man. Oh, another person I can think of... I remember him talking to me, it just happened to be men, but there are women as well, just happened to be talking to me about how lonely he felt. And he actually winced when he was describing his loneliness. Mm. It was palpable, that sense of shame that he felt about admitting that he was so lonely.
Mm.
And so when I saw things about connecting people, I just thought, yes, I'm interested in that, because I know that so many of the service users that I work with talk to me about terrible isolation. And I also work with students in the Art Therapy Northern programme, and they're working all over the north of England, some of them in Scotland, some of them in Wales. And they come back to the course with stories about how they're trying to help people make links with one another.
Yeah.
So I'm thinking, maybe I can use ideas from connecting people to help them think about the whole issue, because I think it's pretty pressing.
Yeah, and there's something I'm picking up on from like what each of you have said as well, something to do with quality and like qualitative, sort of whether that's data or whether that's about the quality of connections you're having. And also there's a lot of talk about barriers that people face. Alongside whose responsibility is it? And I know we've chatted a little bit about like whose responsibility is it to tackle social isolation? Is it everyone's? Yeah, probably. Mm-hmm. But also, what about people with roles and responsibilities, such as in services, social workers, and things like that? So I'm going to put that question out as to whose responsibility we think it is to tackle this issue.
Yeah, I could maybe start and offer a few thoughts on that. Yeah. We developed Connecting People as a model which anybody can use. It's not for any one profession. However, we found it's good for somebody to take a lead, wherever they come from, who can be an advocate and can demonstrate its use and its value within services. And I think the point you're making about quality is really important, because sometimes we're concerned as professionals that people don't have anybody or very few contacts, and we think about it numerically, but it's just having one person who you can confide in maybe is important, or you can spend some time with and do something enjoyable with. And it is that quality of interaction which is really, really valuable. Mm. And I think as sometimes as professionals, we are very focused on making sure that people are safe, which is obviously important.
Yeah.
But sometimes we don't always have the time or the capacity or even the knowledge and the connections in a local community to support people and to see people in a wider social context.
Yeah.
I mean, that makes me think of a conversation I had this week with two women who both of them were service users, and they were both helping one another in a way that was quite remarkable. And then at the end of their conversation, they just said, "Oh, it's good, isn't it, to try and help people? It just makes you feel better if you're not always on the receiving end of other people trying to help you." And they just sort of realise that they've got skills, and because they've been in difficult positions themselves, they know what it's like, and they can perhaps help other people. And that, yeah, they were just commenting about how that makes them feel better in itself.
And I think that's, like, what I hear from that is, like, there's something in empathy and value in one another as humans, and this humanistic idea of, like, experience and lived experience. And I don't know if you want to say a little bit about that, Ellie.
Well, that's what I mean. I know we were talking about earlier, this is a very human thing. Like, connecting is a feature of being human, but that is something that, especially if you're ill for a very long time, if you've got a very chronic illness and you're very isolated for a long time, you can actually lose those skills, those basic skills that everybody takes for granted. And getting just back into connecting with people, socialising, anything like that, is not just a case of just being around people necessarily. Some people need to, like, literally be given the skills back again, and that might look different for different people. Like for example, art therapy is a way for some people to start to express themselves without having to worry about talking to people. I think sometimes it's kind of almost forgotten quite how back to basics sometimes things need to be for people.
Yeah, and there's something in what you said about different for different people. I know myself as a service user as well, and I do arts and theatre and performance. I've suffered with anxiety and depression to the point where I've had home treatment team and things like this. And I've gone through long periods of isolation, even though at the same time I can get up on stage and perform for an hour on my own in front of hundreds of people. And I think there is, like, a perception as well of not realizing that actually mental health and issues with mental well-being are so different for everybody. And that differentiation, I don't know, as practitioners, whether that's really, as well as, like, the quality and qualitative and having that data and how you capture that mixed with this differentiation. I don't know what that's like for you.
It's about understanding people as people and really what their skills, assets, interests and resources are. And part of the connecting people model is starting from where people are, understanding who they are connected to, who those people are connected to, what assets and resources people have, but what they're interested in doing. It's a strengths-based model, which are becoming much more common at the moment.
Yeah.
But it does start with what people want to achieve in terms of setting some very, very straightforward goals in terms of connecting with something new or reconnecting with something that they've done in the past. It's also recognizing the professional doesn't have the answer. So it's a model of co-production where a service user and professional worker sit down together, and there's a sharing of knowledge, and also there's a sharing of maybe ignorance about what is out there to connect to.
That's really important.
And it's breaking down that boundary between somebody who knows things, because it's more often than not that they don't. It's the other person who has the expertise.
There is a saying, isn't there, something to do with the more you know, the less you feel you know.
Yeah.
And there's something about the professional not being the expert and just really trying to help the service user tap into their own resources. So it's true that sometimes when people first come to art therapy, they may feel some relief in not having to talk, but then gradually in the company of other people, they realise that they've got quite a lot to say. Mm. So they might start out quite quietly, but then share a lot. Mm. I really like this idea of a strength-based approach that I'm really interested in. A man, I think he's a social worker called Madsen in America. He's done a few videos and things on the net, and he's all the time trying to help people realise what a huge repertoire of skills they've got, even though they might feel at rock bottom. It's very important. And also the service user movement is really saying to people in a way that is quite challenging sometimes. You know, there's things... Yeah. There's things, the skills that you've got that will help you, and we need to work together in terms of bringing out those skills and your resilience.
Yeah, I think especially when you've, like, we grow our self-esteem by feedback from others. Mm-hmm. So if you're not having that feedback from others, how are you going to build your esteem? And I think sometimes the role of the professional is, like, right at the beginning, being that feedback for someone so they can start to work out what their strengths are. Because if you're by yourself all the time, you're not going to know what your strengths are. Yeah. And then gradually that builds up into, you know, wider social interaction. Because when you're starting from nowhere, you don't know where to start. And I think that's definitely the professional needs to slip in as a sort of surrogate social thing almost at the beginning.
And just linking into what you've just said there, there's something to do with environment and like how, I don't know, when I've felt like at my best, it's usually when I felt empowered to take care of myself, but also when I have had a good therapeutic relationship and when I've had, you know, like a holistic, there's a very holistic thing happening when I'm at my best, and it is to do with, you know, I'm connecting with people in lots of different ways, whether that's through exercise, whether that's through going to therapy, whether that's, I don't know, on the internet or connecting with a hobby that I really enjoyed, friends, anything. But it is about, I guess what I picked up on in the environment with what you were saying is just that therapeutic relationship and how it's framed is really important, because I think if you go in and you automatically maybe get the sense that somebody feels they know your experience, then that kind of puts a barrier up in itself.
Therapist as expert doesn't really serve many people, I think. I think was sort of therapist is prepared to have a conversation and work with the skills you've got. Might be much more helpful. I think all of us would respond better at times of difficulty if someone still thinks, oh, okay, let's think about, okay, Chris, what skills of yours have you got that can help you through this difficult patch? You're much more likely to respond, aren't you?
There's a lot of sort of talk going around at the moment about, actually, it's the relationship between, say, service user and therapist that is actually the thing that makes the difference, not necessarily the type of therapy or the type of intervention that's been done. It's that relationships, again, it's going really back to basic human things. Sometimes we overcomplicate things. Actually, we're quite simple beings.
I was talking with a student the other day who was worried he might not be doing things properly, and I was just trying to say to him, actually,
be human.
You already know what it is to respond to people, to be playful and to respect people. And basically it's not much more complicated than that.
I was going to ask, how did you find writing the model with everything that we said, you know, coming from like a humanistic perspective and knowing what you know through research and stuff? How did you find it in an academic framework, sort of writing a model for this?
Well, it really made sense to us as a team, as working with other researchers and other service users and practitioners to develop. But when we saw it on paper, it kind of made sense. And when we've talked to other people about it, they're saying, yes, in relation to social work, that is what social work was. And you mentioned about the importance of the relationship, that has been at the core of our training in terms of how we do our work, that's the The jargon is the essential ingredient, as it were, but it is about being human, exactly as you're saying, is the important thing. So we found that people really relate to it, but the challenge has been that they're not able to do that in practice, which is the challenge which we've got at the moment. Yeah. There's a lack of connection to our training, and there's a lot of frustration amongst my colleagues. But I don't think it's just in social work. I think in other professions it's the same.
Mm. I think I get that often with the medical students. A lot of them will be very concerned before they start, like, oh, how do I interact with this person who's hearing voices, got hallucinations, things like that. And it really bothers them because they can't relate to that experience. But what I tell them is it's not like what that person is experiencing, it's what you're relating to is the emotions that person's feeling. If they're feeling scared, you empathise with that. If they're enjoying it, you empathise with that. That's what we're looking at. Again, it's the human thing. You don't have to understand every single thing about what a person is going through, but it's back to those basics, the emotions, how it makes you feel, how it makes you react.
Yeah. And if you did understand it all, there'd be nothing left to say, would there? Whereas actually not understanding one another, there's quite a lot to talk about until you can work out.
Which then further creates understanding. Yeah. It's that backwards and forwards.
So, like, there's something... I was looking at barriers. I'd made a little note on barriers. And I was thinking, obviously, there would be barriers to people experiencing mental health difficulties, connecting with people. I feel like everybody would be able to maybe come up with a few, even if they weren't subjectively experiencing mental health difficulties. But I'd never really actually thought about the barriers that might be facing the practitioner or the social worker and what sort of like bureaucratic things or whatever it is that's preventing them from actually doing work that might be more strength-based or humanistic. And that was just a really interesting point, that there's barriers at both ends. And for people sometimes.
And that describes the model. The model's quite unique because it's got barriers as an explicit component within it, and on both sides. It says that the practitioners have barriers to working in this way. They don't have the knowledge of the local area, typically.
Yeah.
And individuals self-isolate for very, very good reasons. People don't want to be connected with others because of mental distress and because of other experiences that they've got, but also stigma of diagnoses. Communities and other groups and people are not always very nice and welcoming, and communities are not always a neutral place to be connected to. The model is saying, don't let these things put you off. We know about these barriers, but this is the challenge, and this is the conversations to have, and also to connect with other people to see how you can together overcome some of those challenges.
And I know that I've got some excellent colleagues in the trust, mental health workers from various disciplines, and they understand about how much people need social connections. They really do. But sometimes the pressure of work means that they just don't have enough time to think things through with some of the service users they're meeting. And I know that that makes them feel sad because they know that people need more than just a few meetings with a mental health worker. They need to begin to be moving back out into the world and making connections with people. And similar barriers for service users. I mean, I know just at the moment, I think, I do have conversations with service users who are choosing whether to ration their heating in the winter or buy more food. And I know that sounds very basic, but it is the case for some people. That, and so then the cost of travel becomes an issue, you know, if they can't travel to make connections with people. And so then just knowing how people get a bus pass is really important. Yeah. And one student, I remember, a lovely student, is qualified now, but from Manchester, and we were talking about helping our service users make connections, and he was saying to me, yeah, Chris, it's as though, just as taxi drivers need the knowledge of the local area, we as art therapists need the knowledge of what's going on in the community so that we can begin to help people make connections and help people have the resources to get to those things. But all professionals need that, don't they?
Yeah. And I'm just thinking about when you were talking about taxi drivers and work, like there's so many people that are, like, whose responsibility is it? There's something about community and just human, I don't know, just being a human. But also about now, like, what are the challenges that we face in, like, 2020 now? And what is it about this model or connecting people or connections that we're sort of struggling with or trying to work towards currently?
I think, as we were discussing earlier, like, there is, we're in a world where we're seemingly more and more connected, but actually people are getting more and more lonely, because we're not, like, family time isn't as valued, people are busy working. But there's also, there is a thing that actually, especially when you're talking about people with mental health problems, a lot of people, they don't necessarily have smartphones, they don't necessarily know how to use the internet, and that's expected now as being a way that you do connect with people. And if you don't have that, like, I think there's certain types of benefits that you can only apply for online, and people don't have access to the internet, they can't apply, so there's barriers everywhere that other people, again, they take for granted, and there's this kind of, like, hidden world where people are just aren't, don't have that access.
And that's social inequality as well, which then sort of affects the social isolation in itself. So that's I imagine that's another thing that comes into it.
It is
the different. Do you think that's something societally and culturally, you know, with things becoming more individualized and more professionalized, do you think that's a barrier for people? And
all of those things.
Definitely.
I mean, I was listening to some people talking in a conference in Holland, and they were talking about having an app on a smartphone for some of the young people who had an early diagnosis of psychosis. And I was thinking, what a great idea. But actually, maybe economically it's more feasible in Holland, because there's just a little bit less social inequality than there is here, whereas I know a lot of people I work with don't have access to a smartphone. So, yeah, social inequality.
It's a very natural thing for us to connect also with people who are similar to ourselves. So people with less access to resources or less access to power are more likely to be connected to others in a very similar social economic position, which makes it more difficult for them to move beyond that. And social media is great. It's great for connectivity, but we live within our bubbles. And I know for myself that on one of my social media feeds, if I find a political view that I don't agree with, I block that person and they're off. You know, I just couldn't be doing with looking at those views. So that's narrowing the kind of the views I'm exposing myself to. We can isolate ourselves. And this is running alongside the rise of racism, the rise of intolerance, and the entrenchment of views within society that were becoming narrower and narrower. Whereas actually we got the tools to
make it wider.
And to connect beyond the groups that we're normally within.
I mean, I work with a small number of refugees, and their experience of making connections is harder because there's so much in the media which tends to stigmatise refugees. When actually they're often very skilled and could contribute a lot. But they may have come from a traumatic situation, but sometimes arriving here, it feels more traumatic making connections.
It's interesting because just listening and reflecting, this might be a bit meta, me saying this or whatever, but just listening, there's when we use language and when we talk, it's interesting because we're all here just as humans having a chat. But when we go back into the world, like our bubble, does that change? Of course it doesn't, but in some ways our profession or our experiences shape, and society shapes sort of, I don't know how to explain it, but you get where I'm coming from. There's like the socioeconomic bubbles that are happening and we're sort of passing each other, or we're able to connect like this, but it's just, it's not happening as much.
I think it also, like, it varies. Like, definitely for me, I live this kind of weird double life situation where I, on the one hand, I work and I, you know, go to meetings and I go to conferences and I'll write stuff and this, blah, blah, blah. But then on the other hand, I'm a service user who, like, lives in services at the moment, and I'll, so I connect with people there in a totally different way to how I would connect with like colleagues at work or in this situation. And so I very much change myself depending on where I'm at. Like I might not be talking about this sort of stuff when I'm back with service users, but then I won't be talking about certain service user issues when I'm at work. And it's a really like I end up having to like watch what I say quite a lot, and that sometimes makes me feel like I'm not and not maybe necessarily connecting with people on the truest level, because I'm always sort of...
But also on the flip side of that, I feel like your role in those, it's like really dualistic, you know, because you're both of these things in one person, and that's actually really important, because that's what we're talking about in terms of like service user experience also being really valued, experience and knowledge, and I think that's really good. I think that's really good that you can be both.
Yeah, it's definitely good that that's becoming more of a thing as well that's listened to, particularly in this area.
Yeah, I don't know if you...
wholeheartedly accept that. And I think as well, in training people who are becoming art therapists, but also being involved in the training of other disciplines, I think we need to help everyone who's training to work in mental health realise that they've got those dual aspects to them, that we've all got troubles and we've all got a professional role, and the two things inform one another, I think.
Yeah, definitely. And I think I've done similar work with working with trainee doctors or psychiatrists to meet somebody with a mental health difficulty. But at the same time, I don't know that they haven't been through something, exactly, but they've just not disclosed it. So actually, I think when we spoke through those sessions that we were having, a lot of the doctors or psychiatrists were saying, I feel a lot of pressure going into this role that I'm not allowed, or I haven't got permission to get well in the same way as the people I'm treating or helping or working with can.
Yeah. We discuss these issues when we do connecting people training because it is about self and it's about you being authentic. And we do think about issues around disclosing aspects of yourself. Yeah. And it's partly what you're comfortable disclosing, but also you're talking about somebody's thoughts, feelings and emotions and their intimate aspects of their life, and you here are not disclosing anything about yourself, which is
an imbalance.
That's right. I mean, of course it's important to have some safeguards or protections and things like that, but also we've got to realize that we are authentically human, and that we might be feeling some of the emotions and experiences that the person that we're working with has.
Absolutely.
I find that really interesting as somebody who's had therapy and is in therapy myself. I've had, therapists disclose at the beginning, if I see you around, I can't say hi. Whereas really, actually, it should just be a question, maybe, for me. Like, would you be comfortable with, because I don't know if there's a strangeness in sharing all these weeks and weeks and weeks of sort of having this relationship, and then all of a sudden it's like I'm going to pretend that this doesn't exist and this never happened. I think personally for me, and this is going back to what Ellie said about differentiation and making it unique to the individual, for me, I'd be quite comfortable if I saw someone in Waitrose or in Asda and be like, hey, and then just pass each other. We don't have to go in depth. But and I think it's about, like you said, Martin, as well, with it being about emotions and experiences and being human, it's really hard to put those walls in once you've opened them up. And so we've talked about why now, we've talked about whose responsibility is it and the environment. So shall I move on to what ideas do people have to tackling this issue? I know we've discussed a lot already, but I don't know, it might be interesting to see if there's anything creative that comes out of what we've said. What is it that connects people? How in 2020 are we connecting with people?
Well, we talked, didn't we, a little bit earlier about how at the turn of this century, so 2000, there was a shift in the world population. So more people moved from rural communities into urban communities. And then Ellie was saying, how important it is that we remember that even though people are moving into cities where there's more people, actually sometimes that leads to more loneliness. And so it's something about cities, isn't it, that actually cities have become so big that we need to...
Is it because they're so big and the services are so small as well? Yeah. And the sort of the amount of places to connect, is there something in space as well? Do we have enough spaces?
It's about the lack of shared social spaces as well. I mean, obviously there's the pub, but we and that is a great social space. But libraries are probably one of the only publicly funded, most of them aren't any longer, spaces which anybody can go into. And I find it a great place to go in because people are browsing the internet, they're reading books, but there's a lot of well-being groups and resources within libraries.
Yeah, no, that's great. I mean, I think in Iceland that's exactly what they use their libraries for. They they have them as community hubs. And I was in our central library the other day, and I'm going there next week with a group of service users. And it's just an amazing space that we could make better use of, I think. So I was thinking I will go and talk to some of the librarians and just see what we could do. But my dream really is to punctuate cities with a number of studios, because I think you would need not just one central studio, but several. And I think
the art studio.
Yeah, but maybe, and another friend of mine says, but you need a cafe attached because people always need to eat, and that'll help people loosen up. And but yeah, we need to just think about how can we punctuate our cities with meeting places. This is great. This place we're in at the moment. I just wonder if people haven't got many financial resources, they might not feel able to come in. I don't know.
I know there's spaces like food hall, like spaces like that, I think.
Yeah, are starting amazing. To come back again. That sort of more communal thing is starting to come back.
Anything which can bring people out of their bubbles, I think, just to connect up with other people who they may not ordinarily meet.
You remember a couple of years ago when Pokemon Go was a massive thing, and that brought loads of gamers out of their dark recesses to stand in parks catching Pikachu. Like,
so you need to educate young psychiatrists. Why do they probably already know? The older psychiatrists probably would section people.
But it's like, I don't know, like... We need to not forget our roots and where we come from, but we have all this technology that could go either way, but we can use that technology to help create more social spaces and whatnot.
Yeah, definitely. And I've been making notes throughout. I've just been jotting down, and that goes back to shared knowledge. It's all about like sharing. Like there's something in sharing as humans that's really integral to what we've been talking about, without any hierarchy and without any sort of, you know, particular language. Or although these things can be barriers, I think actually sharing knowledge, sharing skills, having shared spaces to be able to do these things is really important. To
sharing bags of crisps always better than the individual ones, don't they?
Shared bags of sweets.
But also, and I know it's good not to have hierarchies and stuff, but there are some people in, say, positions of management in the trust, and we do would appreciate them stepping up and actually highlighting these issues, because it's fundamental to mental health. And they almost certainly know that that's the case, and it's just maybe
advocating a bit.
Shifting their priorities just a little bit would make a big difference.
And I guess being in those roles is a privilege, to be able to function in those roles and get those roles and be given that position of managerial or whatever is a privilege. So it's like using that privilege to...
Using the responsibility wisely in a way, isn't it?
Yeah, definitely.
Though no one underestimates how hard that is.
No.
In the present climate.
Yeah, definitely. But it's hard for everyone.
It absolutely is. But the present climate is orientating itself in the direction that we're talking about. Last year saw the publication of a new policy, a community-based framework for mental health services. Connecting people was referenced as one of the models which could be used. And I'm here in Sheffield because Sheffield is embracing this and taking it on board and grappling with the problem of how to actually put it into practice.
Which is really hopeful. I mean, I find it really hopeful as a mental health worker faced with people's palpable sense of isolation.
And we're all here today.
Which is great.
Which is
And we've made a connection.
And this is what it's about, I think. Well, thanks for joining me. and talking all things connecting people. It's been wonderful. If you've got anything to plug or anything you want to say or anything you want to leave on the show notes at the end, we can do that. So any last words or comments?
Oh, yeah, we should mention the Sage Choir.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah, that is on my notes, actually.
This is, for me, one of the best examples in my life of how connecting people really, really works and really makes a difference. So I'm part of a choir, a singing group that's run by an organisation called Sage in Sheffield. We're a group, we meet on a Monday lunchtime for a couple of hours, and it's a group for women who are struggling from something adverse in their life. There's largely mental health problems. We've got asylum seekers, we've got people with physical disabilities, people who are just very socially isolated, and we meet for these 2 hours a week, and it is the most beautiful, warm and fuzzy like environment ever. And it's for some people in that group, it's the only time they have social interaction in a week. And everybody who goes there say that they really feel like it, you know, they can really be themselves there. And there's a woman who was didn't leave her house for 4 years because of her mental illness. And she joined the choir a couple of years ago, and now she sings in other choirs. She's just recorded a CD. She helps at a local church. She's always giving lifts to people. Like, she's a pillar in the local community. And I just think, like, what a fantastic sort of
I saw Sage perform one time, and I just was moved to tears. These people who maybe had felt really vulnerable, but there they were standing proud and singing their hearts out, and it was just great.
People so proud to be in that. And it's a really different bunch of people from all over the world, not necessarily speaking English. Like, I'm considerably younger than the next youngest person, but it doesn't matter to them. But as we've mentioned before about like cuts and stuff, unfortunately we've lost our funding, so we're having to look for different ways of getting funding to keep this going, because it is important. It's something that keeps people ticking over. It keeps them well. It keeps them engaging with the world.
Yeah, and that is an ongoing issue for shared spaces and places to connect. Everything. Funding is a massive issue at the moment for these things.
So we keep raising money.
Find ways around it. Yeah. Brilliant. I think that's us. Thanks for coming.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Okay.